Welcome to Profiling Criminal Minds. I'm Dan.
And I'm Dr. Redmond.
And we are here as we barrel through Season 7 of Criminal Minds. The, as we've been calling it, the transitional season from a show we recognize to just an ongoing dumpster fire. Yeah. This is that middle space between those two things.
This is that transitional year.
Yeah.
Sure.
We all know where it ended up, but let's enjoy the journey getting there. At some point, I'm going to tire of being mean about this, but it hasn't happened yet.
Well, no. The thing is that I have gotten mean about this.
It's weird how much meaner you've gotten. I'm like, have I turned her against this show? And it's like, no. We're just having, I think, honest conversations about the show. And as you said, the show is doing this.
The show is doing this to me because, I didn't feel. I always, when I would read your reviews and everything, you're nitpicking too much.
You're too hard on this show.
And then we started to do the podcast, and I'm going,
Maybe you've got a point here and there?
Oh, yeah, just maybe. Just maybe.
There's a slight chance of it.
Yep.
It is fun, though, because we're going to start with... it's an interesting episode. Like, is it crazy to call this one of the craziest episodes of Criminal Minds ever? Like, this is a bonkers episode.
It's a completely bonkers episode.
And I want to point out that this is a true fact I'm about to lay on all y'all. This show has done two different episodes about werewolves. And this is still maybe its most bonkers episode.
Oh, yeah. This one is just like, okay, what the hell?
What am I even watching? So hit the synopsis. Let's get to it.
This one is called, I mean, even the title is bonkers. And this may be Virgil Williams' first episode.
Really?
Yes. There's no place like home, because of course it's set in Kansas. Whoop-de-friggin-doo.
Well, I mean, in their defense, there are a lot of tornadoes in Kansas. It's a big problem there.
Yes, but the reason that I could, all I can do is think, and if we ever get a sort of a regular web page and stuff for all of this, what we're going to do, right, is I'm going to put up, for this episode, under this episode, we are going to put up Rodney Crowell's You Tore Through My Heart Like a Tornado.
Oh, God, it's so true.
You Tore Through My Heart Like a Tornado Looking for a Trailer Park.
Oh, God. No, it's ridiculous. I mean, it's a patently ridiculous episode. Hit the synopsis.
When the mutilated bodies of two Wichita, Kansas teenagers are found following a series of devastating tornadoes, BAU sets out to catch a Frankenstein-esque killer with a sinister ulterior motive. Meanwhile, JJ deals with unexpected tensions on the home front. I'm not sure they're unexpected, but...
No, kids get sick, but what are you going to do? So a couple of things here. It's weird that it's like a Frankenstein-esque killer with a disturbing or unexpected ulterior motive. I'm like, no, the fact that he's a Frankenstein is the ulterior motive. that's the motive. Mm-hmm. He's a Frankenstein. He's trying to make a beast. He's a Frankenstein. That's the ulterior motive.
He's trying to
bring his brother back to life via murder. Sure. Funny thing about the episode, though, is when I'm watching it, it's strange. Because, you know, I'm a big fan of Josh Stewart, and I think that the relationship between JJ and Will is, you know, the most stable. It's the most stable relationship on the show.
Yeah.
Like, it's the most positive relationship on the show. And, I mean, it's actually kind of endearing just how, like, yay, they're so supportive. They're so wonderful to each other and all that. And so it's great to see him here, even as even as JJ is massively overreacting to the situation. But I mean, there, she's a mother. She's got a sick kid. I understand why she's overreacting. But, you know, Will clearly has a handle on the situation. And at the same time, you totally understand. It's this weird thing where the later revelations completely undo his very reasonable statement in this episode, right? Because what he says to her is, when you were working at the State Department, you know, we actually got to spend time together, and you were home every day at six, right? And, you know, you got to spend time with Henry. We got to spend time together. It was better for us. And she's like, do you want me to quit being a profile? And he's like, no, I can't ask you to do that, but you got to, you know, understand priorities, blah, 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 blah. He's actually quite reasonable about it, because that's the amazing thing about this relationship on the show. Everyone's reasonable all the time. It really yes. is great. But later we will find out that she was actually in Iraq, in Afghanistan the whole time. Like, working on catching terrorists. And so that makes this scene into complete gibberish.
Well, no, actually, it makes the scene where she's with terrorists in Afghanistan complete gibberish.
No, absolutely. No, but I'm just saying, in retrospect, in the same way that everything Emily says about why she wants to be in the unit turns out to be a lie later on, here, like, yeah. this whole scene becomes nonsense when we find out that, you know, JJ also had spy stuff going on.
Yeah.
Weird thing about the opening scene, though, almost all of Josh Stewart's dialogue is looped. Like, he had to come in and redub his dialogue later. And I don't know if it's a situation where his microphone was, because it's all, in all of the close-ups, it's him talking yeah. on the scene on the day, right? But in all of the longer shots of the two of them, I noticed right away he is looped in the dialogue because he sounds slightly different.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's probably just an issue where his mic pack, like, didn't record right, or there was static or something. But it's weird when you notice stuff like that, that there was definitely a recording issue on that day. And yeah. you can totally tell immediately. Yeah, because in a scene like that, when you got people that far away, you don't want to just use a boom mic. You want to actually mic up the actors, and there can be technical problems. So I just thought it'd be a fun if people knew about a weird behind the scene things I noticed.
Yeah. Okay.
It's cute.
Yeah. 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 Will is.
Yeah.
Yeah. The issue
he's
is
very
not
reasonable. Yeah.
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 It's
not the actor. It's not. I'm sure it's not a mistake in his performance. I think it's literally just, you know, probably a technical issue, but, you know, I totally noticed the technical issues. Normally when I notice looping on this show, it's because they've had to rewrite something later, because, like, they noticed a giant hole in the plot, so yeah. they'll, like, record dialogue later to cover up those holes in the plot. And that doesn't happen so much in the early show, but, oh boy, starting this season are we going to start noticing that. And I'll try to point them out when they occur, because it can be pretty noticeable. But yeah, this one, so it's nice because it sets up the thing. There's a bit of a, what do you call it? Like, there's a bit of a tension for JJ because, you know, the kid has a seizure from his fever. So they have to take him to the hospital, and she worried that she's not home enough. And so it's like, it's all completely understandable parental and new mother stuff. And I thought it was perfectly well handled to put a little drama in the background of the scene that doesn't distract too much from the plot of the episode.
Yeah, and I suspect that that's actually her real son.
Right, because she did go off and have a kid.
Well, she did have the child when she yeah. was when she ended up having to marry. That was lucky for Josh Stewart.
It was really lucky for Josh Stewart because the actor got pregnant. And they had just had her flirting with a guy 10 episodes before she got pregnant. They're like, maybe she started dating that guy.
Yeah, maybe she's getting married because she's pregnant for sure. She's pregnant. She's going to be away for a few weeks, so yeah. We can't lose JJ. So lucky for Josh Stewart.
Yeah, you're right. I think it is weird how just fundamentally lucky it was for that actor.
Yeah,
that she decided to get pregnant X amount of time after he had guest starred on the show.
You know, and what happened is that she did have Henry playing at times, and I was just looking at IMDb and there's no listing for the child. So I suspect it really is her son.
Makes sense.
Because you could just see the way he says, "Mommy."
Yeah.
You're going, "Oh, hey, okay,
they just brought in her
it's
actual
mommy."
You know, let's throw AJ Cook an extra couple of bucks. Oh. To bring in her own kid every now and then.
Yeah, well, yeah, her son's trust fund, because... Yeah,
there you go. Well, hopefully.
Yeah. Well, that's the way it's done now in ever since...
Oh, no, what? Ever since, yeah.
The massive mismanagement of my children.
Yeah, even all the child star stuff. You say that, but it's like, not all that child star stuff was so brutal of the child stars of the 40s and the 50s, and even going into the 60s, but... You know, there's still plenty of child stars of the 80s whose parents destroyed their finances, so.
Oh, yeah. No. I mean, Macaulay Culkin is one.
Corey's. Look what happened to Emmanuel Lewis and, oh, God, I'm blanking on the one from Different Strokes. Like, both of them. The point is, there's a lot of child stars whose parents screwed them over, and I'm sure AJ Cook isn't one of them. I just chose to say something mean for no reason.
Well, no. It's as I said, it's not a business you want your children in.
No, of course not. We've talked about that a lot, and hopefully they don't pursue it as child actors. Although, I mean, we do keep seeing the same kid actor for, like, years and years on the show. Yeah. But I mean, it's like take your son to work day. I'm sure it's just I'm sure it's not a big deal for them.
Well, for JJ, no, yeah. Because it's, as you say, take your son to work day, and they use the same child, I think, for
I think Jack. So. It's always Jack. It's always the same Jack in all of the scenes with
Aaron.
With Aaron, which, you know, feels a little sorry for that kid losing a job, but. of all of the things that happened bad, that went bad when Thomas Gibson is fired from the show, I think the least we have to worry about is that kid losing his job.
Yeah,
but it is one of the things I thought about, because I'm weird that way.
Yeah. Yeah, so anyway, yes,
let's focus on this actual episode, not just the JJ stuff. But it's such a crazy episode.
It's so crazy. Now, mind you, writing wise. Yeah. I'm sort of sitting here going, okay, yeah, well, I guess it kind of works, sort of.
Like it's fine.
Yeah, and even he could come up with that bizarre idea that if the tornado killed him, then, you know, seeing as it killed his mother as well, and the kid is just like, he loses his brother, he loses his mother. There's this horrible pedophile situation.
And his brother went to kill the pedophile, and he ended up, and the two of them ended up getting killed by a tornado at the same time.
Yeah, and the mother gets killed by the tornado too.
Yes. And so obviously tornadoes have taken everything, so he's obsessed with tornadoes. Like, yeah, I understand the rationale.
Well, no. As I said, it, you know, when you think about it, so you can see this kid in his head at some point later on coming up with this bizarre idea that somehow or another
he's going to get tornadoes to bring somebody back. But at the same time,
well, Dorothy came back.
Absolutely. But the problem is, I don't understand how thinking that a tornado is going to bring your brother back to life, it translates to cut people apart and sew back together a new Frankenstein brother who will then be animated by this Frankenstein corpse will then be animated by a tornado. It's that part of the, like, it's that part of it that I have issues with.
As we all know, this kid was not the brightest, I am sure, was not the brightest bulb in the house, you know. Yeah. So consequently, you know, and I mean, the thing is that he's young enough to make these warped associations. And if nobody, like, starts to make these warped associations, people...
And if nobody is in there to teach him how the world works, because he just ended up in the foster care system, where I'm sure he continued being abused.
Yeah.
Like, he never got a chance to get better.
Yeah, and he ends up on the street. So he comes up with this trying... I mean, human beings are meaning-creating animals.
Yeah.
We have to create meaning.
For
and
absolutely.
so you have all of these people. I mean, if there is anything that is that you can walk away from Criminal Minds is that people can make really, 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 really bizarre meanings out of what happened to them as children.
That's true. Well, no, but it's like if there's, you're right. I think if there's a sub like theme to the show about that, it's that people will go to extreme lengths to rationalize what has happened to them and yeah. give purpose to it. And seriously, like, that actually happens in the next episode as well.
Yeah.
Like, if we were looking for a sub-theme, that's actually a pretty good sub-theme for the whole show, which is that, you're right, people will always build a story around their own lives.
Like, yeah.
And that's just, that is just completely true of this episode. And it's kind of fascinating, really, right? Because you're right, like, the pieces are all there to get the guy there. I still find the Frankenstein element of it a little preposterous.
I know. Well, I
like, if he was just sacrificing kids. Well, yeah, that's the thing. It's like, where did he, if he was sacrificing these kids to the whirlwind in the hope that the whirlwind would give his brother back, I would sign off on this episode 100% every part of the plot. But it's that extra crazy layer of, oh, he's also cutting these boys up.
Yeah.
And turn it to try and build a Frankenstein brother that he thinks is going to be physically animated by the tornado. That's the extra level of craziness that I just
can't.
It doesn't really make sense to me. Although, yeah, it's, I can't stomach that part. That's the one. It's like, I gotta draw the line somewhere.
It was a horrible episode.
Oh yeah, it's disgusting. I think it's really disgusting.
Yeah, horrible. No, but.
Also, you do wonder, it's like, when you see that he's killing them by bashing them in the head with a tire iron, my first thought is really, so how on earth is that creating such a memorable wound that you wouldn't think that these bodies were just torn apart in a, like, that you wouldn't immediately think, oh, these bodies were just torn apart in a tornado, because we're expected to believe that the medical examiner, who's dealing with, like, a dozen corpses.
More than that, actually.
More than that, right? Be it with these tornadoes. Like, I don't know. This head wounds look pretty suspicious to me. I'd better, you know, check to see if there are other people with the same head wound. And then they call the FBI.
Yeah.
It seemed like a bit of a stretch getting them there. And the funny part
is, particularly since he doesn't do them in this all in the same tornado, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, all like, in this, you know, it's like if they all came in the same tornado, maybe he'd catch them. But
yeah, but it's like one tornado, and you'd think they'd be like the bodies would be thrown very far enough away that like it would be harder to make the connection. And also, and I can't stress enough, like this guy is in the middle of a tornado, walking out, like taking this kid outside. Smashing him in the head with a tire iron to death, and then using a hatchet to cut off the limbs while a tornado is going on. Right? And somehow the wounds are so precise that the ME is like, this is definitely the same guy. It just seems like such a stretch to me.
Yeah, well.
That's the show. That's the show.
Yeah, I know you're getting to my turn. Well, yeah, but you know, it's Criminal Minds.
It's kind of funny because it's like this is the perfect example of, and what I always talk about in my reviews, and I mean, you've noticed this, I'm sure, is that like they'll do this elaborate, you know, they'll go to ridiculous lengths to try and profile the killer, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, they'll catch him. Not because of, you know, the profile they did, but because there's just a witness. You know?
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happens this week. It's kind of funny because the kid, like, the like they have all of this thing. It's like, great, we know the type of thing he does. He's going after hustlers, like kids who are on the street and have to, right, who are on the street and have to, you know, get... have to sell themselves for money. Like it's unpleasant. It's what he does, right? And so they're going away with him and they're getting killed and it's brutal and scary. And then suddenly he just grabs like a random guy off the street And I hate to say that this is the message of the show, but the police sure get off their asses when that, you know, honor roll student is the one who gets kidnapped. And I know you can say, well, you know, if the other street kids had called about the missing kid the night before, maybe they would have done the same thing. And I'm like, would they though? Right.
Would they though? Come on.
Come on.
Come on. Well, not only that, but did you notice the line about how they profiled him as looking for the protectors?
Yeah.
You know, and I'm just going, okay, I don't know where you got that from.
No, but I mean, it's one of those lines.
They got the protectors, and therefore he must have lost a protector figure in his life.
I think, I mean, Penelope. It's possible. It is 100% possible that there was a scene cut for time where they talked to the three kids that, like, because he kills that guy. He kills that one teen, right, who was looking after the other teens and saying, you can't. And the thing is, had there been a scene where they talked to those kids, then, you could totally get that he's focusing on protectors.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I don't know if you really could extrapolate that, because the little kids look nothing like the other guys he's been killing, and the guy he takes, the quote-unquote protector, looks exactly like the guys he's been killing. So, in point of fact, it had nothing to do with the guy, fact that the guy was a protector, and it had everything to do
with how he looked.
The fact that he exactly met the visual profile of looking just like his brother.
Yeah.
So, I think there was probably a missing scene that they either cut or never shot from the script, where they find out that he was the one who was looking after the other kids.
Yeah.
And they use that to try and build the profile. But the point is, that's not even relevant to the guy's choice of victims. He's only looking for guys who look like his brother.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating thing because, of course, the line about the protector is before you see him going to get the protector.
The little brother. Yeah, the protector guy is protecting his little brother. And then they use that as confirmation of their theory about him. Because looking for his.
It's not the honor student. It's the guy in the
park. Yeah.
Yeah, in the park where.
Oh, I thought it was after the guy in the park.
No, it's before the guy in the park, because I specifically went, oh, okay, because they say it, and then he comes, you see him in the park getting the protector guy.
Oh, God. Okay, well, then I got nothing.
you got nothing.
I remembered it as being before, but okay, I got nothing. I can't defend that at all. And the weird part is, like, they end up catching him because, well, they know a guy who sacrifices people to tornadoes. We've just had a call that a guy got kidnapped. Let's just drive to wherever the new tornado is. And that's how they get him. And then the guy, you know, kills himself via tornado because... That's a completely long. No, I'm not going to question that decision. I totally buy that from that character.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he's crazy enough to think the truck tornadoes are magic.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, in a sense, aren't tornadoes magic?
Aren't
though?
I know.
They're pretty amazing.
We've all seen Dorothy.
Oh, exactly. We've all seen The Wizard of Oz. We know how this stuff works. We're scientists. Anyway.
But you know, the wizard wasn't, he couldn't get her back except for the shoes.
That's true. Only the shoes could get it back. So science, at a certain point, you have to abandon science and you know, start looking towards magic.
Yep. As you said last show,
I did.
Nothing like magic.
It's true. I love it. All right. So thing is, it's...
No. Oh,
please.
Oh.
What?
Wait, did you see Doug Hennings?
No. Doug Hennings what?
Did you? No, I just found, it was so funny because after, I'm cleaning up and throwing out and cleaning up. And I found a brochure for a Doug Henning magic show.
I've never seen a Doug Henning magic show. But I wish I had. He was amazing. He was a really wonderful magician.
I wonder where it came from.
I'm going to give you a hint and then you're not going to talk any more about it.
Okay.
He had a very prominent association with the Natural Law Party.
Oh, that's right.
That's why I have it.
Okay.
All right. So, moving on.
I forgot about the natural
law. Yeah, a lot of people forget about the natural law party. It's one of the crazier things that happened in Canada in the 90s. And it's just like, children of today, you don't know how boring the world was in the 90s. Like, you can't imagine how boring the world was and the crazy nonsense that happened after the Berlin Wall fell.
Yeah.
Like, when the Cold War ended, America got real, real bored and lazy. And, well, you know what? We can talk later about what that caused when we get into the terrorism episodes of this. But, yeah, it was boring and lazy enough that, like, a stage magician was like, what if yoga should run the... What if we run the government based on yoga?
Yep,
real thing that happened in Canada.
Natural law party.
Natural law? What if yoga can help us run the government?
And meditation, transcendental meditation.
It's central to yoga as well. Yep. Yes. It's fascinating. It is a fascinating story of the natural law party. But we're not here to talk about that. Let's move on to our second episode.
Hope.
Oof.
When a member of Garcia's victims support group goes missing shortly after acknowledging the 7th anniversary of her then adolescent daughter's abduction.
Nope. Her daughter was 8.
Sorry,
that really bothers me that they would mess up such a frigging crucial detail of the episode. But anyway, sorry. Please continue.
No, it says the 7th anniversary
of her then adolescent daughters. That's the thing. They're saying
adolescent daughter wasn't abducted.
That's what I'm saying. They're saying then adolescent. No. The writer seems to think she was 15 when she was abducted and would have been 22 now.
No, she was 18. She was 8 years old.
Yes, and she was 15 abducted. And she was 14 when she killed herself. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's disgusting. But anyway, it's just, it's weird. We joke a lot about the bad writing, but this is of these synopses, but this is actually getting a fundamentally important part of the story.
Well,
wrong.
This is when I go, okay, did you actually watch the show? There have been a number of them. Somebody.
It happens a lot.
Hopefully can count this, you know, that, okay, did this guy actually watch the show? Whoever did the synopses didn't understand what they're watching.
Yeah, that could happen.
And I can see where at one point it's a little bit confusing, except that, yeah, no, the daughter would have been 15 maybe. Oh, no.
She was explicitly 8 years old when she was kidnapped, and she died last year. It's the 7th anniversary, so she was 14.
Right. She died around the 6th anniversary, so she was 14.
They do stress it in the episode. Meanwhile. Meanwhile, Morgan.
Oh, no, the BAU. No, 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 no. That's the next step.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I've done a heplography thing. The BAU sets out to establish a connection between the two events.
Yeah.
Now, the first thing I would have to say is how the fuck did they not find this 8-year-old who happened to be within a 2-mile radius of this house.
And I mean, I know he kept her locked away her whole life, but Jesus Christ, they didn't do much of a search, did they? He lived a couple of streets away.
Yeah, and the daughter's best friend actually saw
the guy. And by the way, like,
and why wasn't the BAU sent out to deal with this abduction?
When it's in their own backyard.
It's in their own backyard.
Yeah. It's really upsetting that it happened 1 year before the show started, is the timeline. Because it happened 7 years ago, and the show started... she was kidnapped... Oh, no, she was kidnapped 7 years ago. So she was kidnapped during the first season of the show. And the BAU was not called out to work on the case.
Yeah. Excuse me. This is
what
FBI.
Were they doing? It was so important, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that was that that was my biggest problem with this, was when they find out that he's within, well, first of all, it's the 20-mile radius, but we already know, because he's been talking to her, that he lives within 2 miles.
Yeah. Yeah, he lives right, and he's taken part in her support group, and he lives right there, and he's been in contact with her for a year. You know, like, it's...
No, but even before that, you know... Even
I'm saying he's lived there, but he's been in, like, week to week talking to her for a year.
Yeah.
You know, and Jesus, ugh. Yeah, it's an unpleasant episode in a lot of ways, and it's very frustrating to imagine that the team could have solved this one at any time and saved that girl, but they never got around to looking on a kidnapping. And by the way, I mean... Why isn't Garcia saying this woman has been in her support group for X amount of years, right?
Yeah.
Why isn't Garcia saying to the team, by the way, you know, I run a support group for victims of crime, or like victims who've had, people who've had, whose family members have been victims of crime. Maybe you could look in on this child abduction where I talk to this woman frigging every week? You know, like, it is weird that the kit team wasn't already on this and the girl dies essentially because Garcia never told them to look in on this case. Like, it's this, I mean, I don't even know if I really, maybe I never even realized that when I was doing my initial review, but it's a creepy thing to think about.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is it, you know, and Garcia, well, no. So this means what? Garcia just accepted the police's report that she was probably dead.
Yeah, but even still, there's no reason not to try and catch the guy. She works with this team. She knows that if the girl is dead, then that guy's probably looking for his next victim.
And so why aren't they looking for other?
Yeah.
And then that should tell him something. Plus, the girl, her best friend, how come
had
this
information?
Guy...
Yeah.
Not only that, had information the BAU could have gotten from her, because they did the minute they got there, because they would have known that she was holding something back.
Of course.
So
say what you will about the show, they're good at doing that kind of interviews, especially with kids.
Yeah, and the other thing, the other thing is this guy lives in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Did she this never girl, see him again?
It's weird that the friend never saw him again for the next frigging 8 years.
Years?
When he lives in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, like, their inability to catch this guy, the fact that Garcia never mentioned it, the fact that this girl supposedly kept, and she apparently still lives in the neighborhood, because they just drive right over to her school, that in 8 years she never saw this guy again, the fact that Garcia didn't have the team look into this the way they should have, like, every part of this episode, it just seems like everybody botched it and dropped the ball. And what's so infuriating about that is, it wouldn't be so bad if they had rescued the girl, but the girl also died.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what makes it so frustrating, because everybody
I would have accepted if they had rescued her and she had a baby.
Yeah, we would have accepted all of that, but no. Like, no, we get this horrible sequence with this dead girl and a mummified corpse, and, like, the mother gets sexually assaulted. Jesus Christ, this episode.
The mother gets raped, so...
Okay, say that if you... the mother gets raped. Like, it's just such an unpleasant episode in every part.
And all I could keep thinking about was, did she get pregnant?
Well, no, that's what they want you to be thinking in the episode.
Now, and what I hope is that she immediately, see, I don't know what the laws are like, but hopefully she went and got the morning after pill.
Yeah. Jesus
right
Christ.
Away.
Yeah, right no, it's, away. That is exactly what they're going for in the episode. That is the question they want you asking, and they don't frigging address it at all.
No. And it's
very frustrating.
Okay, did she kill him?
Yeah, no, she killed him.
Okay, then why the hell is she out?
The what do you call it? They all lied to protect her. The whole team just lied to protect her. They definitely lied to protect her. Why would they not lie to protect her? I mean, the weird part is, later on this show, we're going to do an episode, you know, 6 years from now, where the team refuses to lie in a situation where it is not only moral to lie, but immoral not to lie. Okay? And we'll talk about it when we get there. But in this, the only takeaway from this episode is that when they wrote their report, they said that she wrestled the gun away from him and shot him.
Yeah.
They definitely wrote the report that way to protect her. And I'm not saying they shouldn't have done it. Of course they should have done it. That was the right thing to put in the report. Okay?
Yeah.
But it is weird when so often the team is so awful about so many things that it's like, this is the time when they just let a woman get away with murder and don't even talk about it.
Yeah, don't even talk about it. Like, it's like...
I think, like, the, I feel like there's an episode. I'm trying to remember if the guy who, like, who was going back to murder all the women that he had raped earlier and, like, you know, cut up people with piano wire. I don't remember the exact plot of that episode, but I'm trying to remember the end of that episode, whether she also kills him, because I feel like when I was reviewing that episode, she might have not killed him, and my response might have been, oh, just kill him. The team will let you get away with it, like they did in this situation this week. Because my takeaway this week was, they let her kill him. Because she's not in jail at the end of the episode.
I know! She's out there, and...
They're doing the thing
butterfly
for her daughter.
Thing. Yeah.
For the memory of her daughter. Right? And it's like, but she killed a guy. And I want to stress, I'm fine with killing any rapist.
And she would have gotten off if she'd gone to trial.
Oh, of course, yeah. But I think they just lied. Like, the implication can only be that the team lied to cover for her. And I don't have a problem with that doing that. I have a problem with the way they selectively decide to do that later.
Well, and this is why... No, but this is why, to go back to the inside...
Yeah.
There are rules.
It's true.
There are specific rules. And they don't get broken in the inside. Now, you know, maybe
well,
if it
I
had
mean,
lasted.
Webb does, you know, he does kill that guy in the first episode.
But it's but rules, yeah. Right?
Yeah,
oops,
no, right.
I got that backwards.
Yeah. They at least put in the... But yeah, you're right. And I think that's the key part, is why this is frustrating is not that they violated their rules. It's that they're not acknowledging that this is a rule that they're violating, and it's a big deal that they're violating it. Like,
why don't we have a scene where Garcia says, please.
Begs to them.
Yeah.
Begs them not to put it in the report.
Yeah.
And then they go along with it because they realize this woman has suffered enough, and that guy needed to get shot in the face. Right? Like,
yeah.
You needed that scene. So, I don't know how, like, and a perfect example of that is, right? Is, I don't know if you remember the show, how well you remember Homicide: Life on the Street.
Well, I do, and
well
I
enough. Yeah, I mean, well, you remember The Wire better, but, you know.
Yeah, The Wire I remember.
The Wire is amazing. But Homicide: Life on the Street is the proto-Wire in every way, shape, and form.
Yeah.
Really good show. It's why we have Andre Brower as a famous person. And, you know, that's why Brooklyn Nine-Nine is successful, because of Andre Brower. So, he's the best. No, he is the best. I loved him on Homicide. I loved him on that one season show where he played a professional thief. I loved him on the show where he was, the one season show where he was a submarine captain who committed treason against the United States government. Because he find out they were trying to, you know, start a war with Pakistan. Like, he's an amazing actor. He's always been an amazing actor. But the point is, there's an episode in the first season where I think you can check this for me. It's some famous old timey actor, might be George C. Scott. Anyway, he plays a guy who's dying of dementia and orders his son to shoot him. Right?
Uh-huh.
And the son does it. And the homicide guys come in, and Daniel Baldwin, who plays one of the cops in the first season, he's only there in the first season. He knows the old man. He knows the son. He knows that it's what he guaranteed that it's true. It's what the old man wanted. And there's this horrible scene where he has to choose between doing this by the book and doing what's right. And he has to essentially, like, beg another cop to help him do the right thing in this situation because he's too close and he's not the one investigating the case. Because if he was investigating the case, he would look out for his friend. He would know it's the right thing to do. But he's not the one investigating. So there's this scene where he has to beg another cop to compromise his own values and do this. And it's a really powerful scene. And I'm like, that's what Garcia needed to do this week.
Yeah.
They needed her to make every possible argument and beg and just say, you have to let this woman go. Yeah. This is too much. He needed it. You have to write this report the right way. And you have to have them be convinced by her. You do that, and oh god, it redeems the ending of this episode, but it doesn't redeem what an unpleasant episode this was overall, and how bad this episode makes the team and Garcia look. That doesn't get redeemed, but at least you'd have the right ending to the sick, disturbing episode they wrote.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the sisterhood is not happy.
Yeah, no.
The sisterhood wrote this one, too.
Seriously?
Yeah, oh Kimberly God. Ann Harrison wrote this one.
God damn it.
She doesn't write great. Yeah, she doesn't write great ones either. Anyway.
So frustrating.
It's truly
frustrating. All right.
As I said, they have to outdo the horrors that the men create.
Oh, hey, remember how I told you to keep a list of the... God, there might be something in there when we write our book on Criminal Minds.
Yeah.
You know, because I feel like that's going to happen eventually now that we're doing this. There is worth looking into whether in the culture of the writing room or whatever, the women feel pressure to do more, to pitch more unpleasant things than the men are pitching as a way of fitting in.
Just a moment. Okay.
Like, is that possible or is that crazy?
Well, I don't know, because it's really interesting to listen to. It may not be it's really weird because it's Deborah Fisher, right?
Yeah.
In the beginning, in that first year. And remember, the two of them are sitting there.
And Erica Messer sits in there talking about it. Yeah.
And the two of them are talking about it with the woman, you know, in the Bernardo. Tony Cardardo.
Yeah, we all know what they were doing.
Okay. And they all talk about how horrible it is and how did they really write this, right?
Yeah.
Like, and it may be not a conscious thing.
Oh, no, I mean, I don't know that it is conscious. Like, I think there's just a good chance, right? I think there's a good chance that it is the culture of the writing room, and that is what I'd be interested to do research and talk to the writers about. Like, what is the culture of this writing room? I don't think they'd ever want to talk to us, given how we talk about their work.
Yeah.
But if we ever had the chance to, that is the thing I would find most interesting. Being able to talk to them and say, well, what is the culture of that writing room like?
Yeah.
And are you, like, is there this pressure for the women to be more unpleasant than what the men are pitching? Because it wouldn't shock me.
No.
If that was the case. Me. You know?
And even if there's not pressure, there may be an unconscious pressure. Because it was, as I said, it was really strange to see. That was the one thing in suspect behavior. Remember, I mentioned it. There were just these two women and they wrote two episodes.
Yeah.
In the writing room of suspect behavior. But it was a consistent writing room, so...
No, it was. It was just 13 episodes, so, yeah.
Yeah, they did a good episode, so...
You know, again, that's a question of, well, what's the writing room like in suspect behavior when Chris Mundy is co-running things versus what's the writing room like in the original show? So, yeah, that's something that we're going to be talking about more later. But, yeah, this is an episode that's just... The problem with this episode is not just that it's, you know, that it's got that terrible ending, but it really does make everybody look bad. So, Can we now, since you're keeping that list of all the stuff that happened, this episode is loosely based on the film The Vanishing, where a man has his, I mean, you might remember this. A man has his wife or girlfriend disappear while they're on vacation. She's just gone. And he spends years obsessing over and looking for it. And then one day, the guy who took her just shows up and says, if you come with me, I'll let you know what happened to her. And that is, and now that I've said that that is the plot of that, you can see that this is just a one-to-one recreation of that, except that one was about, that one was very different in its treatment, and it wasn't about, you know, grooming a child to become your slave wife. It's a very different episode. And it's a more unpleasant thing than the original film, The Vanishing, which is saying something. The Vanishing is pretty unpleasant.
The Vanishing. Yeah, I do remember The Vanishing.
It's a rough movie. But yes, if you're making that list of stuff that episodes are ripped off of based on whatever you want to call it, this is The Vanishing episode. Fun fact about The Vanishing. They remade the movie. The same writer-director remade the movie for Hollywood like 2 years later. I think it was Dutch originally, but might be. His name is Sluizer, which seems to me like probably a Dutch name, but I could be wrong. Somewhere, I mean, he could be German. The point is, or Danish, you know what? It's not important where he's from. But yeah, he made the he remade the movie for American audiences like right after. And the only, literally, it's the exact same movie, except it just has a happy ending. So if you don't want to, if you want to see the movie we're talking about, but you don't want to be depressed at the end of it, watch the American version. So yeah, if you want to find out the base of this one, but you don't want to be depressed, there's your answer.
There's your answer. Spoorloos. Okay, its original title, yeah, it's got to be Dutch. Spoorloos.
Oh no, yeah.
Spoorloos. Spoorloos.
That's definitely Dutch.
You
That's
would think, Dutch. Yeah. I can't, I,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, so yeah, Bervoets. I'm looking at the names. Bervoets, Johanna der Stege, no, Eckhouse.
Okay, it's a Dutch movie. We can stop.
Yeah.
All right, move on to our third episode of the day, which is, in its own way, the craziest episode.
But René Auberginois.
René Auberginois.
Is just Odo is wonderful.
The man's magnificent, it always has been. Synopsis.
Self-fulfilling prophecy. When the Florida Military Academy students are found dead in an apparent mass suicide, and another student goes missing, the BAU suspects things are not what they seem. I'm sorry.
It's okay. It's fine. You're allowed to laugh. I would find it weird if you didn't laugh.
I'm really trying not. Meanwhile, Morgan butts heads with Hotch after Strauss makes an uncharacteristic move. as I said, and now that we know that Derek Morgan and Thomas Gibson didn't get along. I tell you, it really, I tell you, every time I look at these scenes now, I keep thinking, oh, that just adds a reality to that adds a reality to this, these,
to the conflict they have with one another.
It makes a lot more sense. I should have looked at that earlier. Anyway, yes. Okay. So, yes. So I don't know why they called it self-fulfilling prophecy, though.
No. It really, the title has nothing to do with the episode. I guess they're saying if you bully people, they become, like, if the thing was about how a guy had tried to beat bullying out of people and then they became bullies, then I would understand that it was a self-fulfilling prophecy. But that's not what the episode is about at all. It's about a guy who encourages bullying, René Auberginois, a kid who kills himself over the bullying, and then René Auberginois tries to get the father of that kid to murder the person who's going to turn him in over it.
Yeah. That's exactly what it's about. And
that's
it's
the plot of the episode.
As I said, it's Full Metal Jacket.
Yeah.
I mean, this
the
is
difference
this
being
is
Yeah. And here's the crazy part. Do you want to know what's a better episode?
What?
I'm just going to tell you. Auberge Noir sends the sixth. The father of the son is not a part of the episode. Yeah. Rene Auberge Noir. I keep wanting to say Robert. Rene Auberge Noir sends the kid who's going to turn him in on this leadership thing that he's not supposed to.
So the other guys will
send
kill him
in. So the other guys will kill him, and he literally has to kill them in self defense.
Yeah,
that's episode.
That's your episode.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, because this episode makes literally no sense. He goes and he tries to get a father to hunt down one kid who's with five other kids in the woods. And then, even though the father knows that the kid that Rene Auberge Noir sent him to kill wasn't involved, because he's got his son's diary who said who all the bullies were.
Yeah.
Right? Even though he knows that kid wasn't involved, he then continues trying to kill that kid. It doesn't make any sense at all.
It doesn't make any sense why he would try and kill that kid.
No. But if you do the episode we just pitched, that Rene Auberge Noir sent that kid out to die, and that kid killed the other five kids in self-defense.
Yep.
And honestly, only self-defense for the first one or two, and then he went a little nuts because look at the situation he was in. Yeah. He had people sent to murder him. You know, like... Then this episode is more, and then he goes freaking hides in the woods and turns into Rambo, you know?
Yep.
Like, I would totally understand where that kid was coming from, and it's a better episode, and it's an episode that makes sense. Renee's still a friggin' even more of a monster than the show puts him at, because he would have been sending these other, like, bully kids to murder somebody at his behest. But honestly, I could believe that from the character.
Yeah, for the good of the school, for the good of the core. School.
Like, he's such a, I'm trying to remember the term, like a martinet.
That's exactly the word.
Yeah, he's like this martinet who's like a guy who just runs things based on this system, and he's like a close-minded monster who runs things based on efficiency and the time and protecting the system and blah, 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 blah. And it's like, yeah, I would believe that his character would do that.
Yeah.
But if you add in this extra element of the father, like, it muddles everything, and it takes all the power away from the episode.
Okay, and the sisterhood is not happy about this episode either.
Seriously?
This is Erica Messer.
Oh, okay. Well, it's a big plot episode about getting rid of, dealing with the whole... Aaron Strauss storyline, so I understand why she'd want to write it herself. I get that. It's funny, though. How did they not notice they had named two characters Aaron? And I mean, I go back to, they did notice, but they were planning on firing Thomas Gibson 2 weeks after they introduced this character, so it did not occur to them that it was going to get confusing having
two Aarons
around. And their plans to fire Thomas Gibson were ruined by Mandy Patinkin quitting.
Yeah.
And they stayed ruined for, a good 10 additional years. He managed to hold out for 10 more years after they tried to fire him. So, Thomas Gibson, we tip our caps to you.
Yeah.
Here's what I didn't understand, though, right? So, they find out later in the episode, right? That, weirdly late in the episode, the kind of monstrous abuse that Renee was encouraging the kids to do. Right?
It's just unreal.
No, yeah. And I don't understand why, like, these people know how military schools are run. They understand the culture of military schools. They're all grown-ups. They work at the FBI. And weirdly, all of them are, every single character on the team is contemptuous towards the idea of military school.
Yeah. Well, like, this is why.
Yeah. So my question is, when they find out about the first suicide, why wasn't their first question to every student, well, what's the hazing?
Yeah.
Because they find out, like, about the sticking people in dryers so late in the proceedings I'm like, how isn't, you think right off there are five more suicides after a first suicide. Well, this must be about hazing because it's frigging military school. And by the way, it is about hazing.
Yeah.
Why isn't this is all about hazing their absolute first question?
Well, because they live in a world where they believe stupid things when a military academy says they don't use corporal punishment and somebody believes them. No, haven't you seen Full Metal Jacket?
I know. I have. They haven't. No, it is.
It is one of the biggest. It's the one of the biggest problems in the military across the board.
Yeah.
And in all of the schools, because it's the culture. And then it got even worse when women were allowed in.
Oh, yeah.
So what are you talking about that you've got this stupid military academy and your first question isn't hazing? Yeah, it isn't like, about, okay, what are you doing? You know,
how are you abusing these kids? Because everything that happens there is abuse. Don't get me wrong. It's abuse designed to gain a specific result.
Yeah.
But it's still abuse.
It's still massive abuse.
And yeah, it's abuse. I mean, we talked about this in the episode where we were talking about special forces guys. Like, it's abuse designed to craft a result, and you're doing it to children. And what's crazy is that at the same time, they have every character on the show be virulently against the concept of military academies. But they all, despite the fact that they hate military academies, none of them are saying, oh, well, this is definitely about hazing. Tell us about the hazing.
Yeah.
No, they're like, no, you. And they're like, oh, well, we'll talk to the kid. We'll talk to one of the kids in front of a giant line of other kids. I'm like, no, you get them alone. You know that places like this have cult style behaviors that like having groups of people. All the time on this show, whenever there's a group of killers, you always talk about having a number of people together reinforces the psychoses because it becomes a performative group behavior. Like the insanity becomes the thing you have to do to stay as part of the in-group. This is the kind of stuff they talk about on the show all the time. Yet when they interview, and so when they're dealing with cults, obviously the first thing you do to, what do you call it? To get information you need is you isolate them, you split them apart, you interview them one by one, and that's how you get the information you need. Yet even though military school indoctrination profiles exactly the same as cult indoctrination, they don't treat these kids like they're in a cult.
Well, yes, but no, it's okay in the military. The military is not a cult. The military is a vaunted
institution in our nation's history.
Yeah, they would never do things like this, you know. I mean, every time, because it's the same thing with child abuse across the board. It's no, it's the exception.
For their own good.
These children, it's all for their own good, and these children all have to toe the line. You always have these kids who end up in the military who have useless lives. I mean, not useless lives, but horrible lives. And they go in the military and the military straight.
That's their only way out.
For God's sake, how many of these profilers, like when I was reading, I mean, we haven't talked about this in a while, right?
The number of the profilers who were abused as children and then went into the military?
I wouldn't even bother with the abused as children thing. Just how many of them are
They're all military guys.
Military, like they were in the military. They're retired military.
Yep.
They're, you know, I mean, the one guy, wrestler.
Yeah.
Right. Was doing all of this other stuff while he was in the military.
Even. Yep.
You know, he wasn't supposed to, but, and even, it
is honestly weird on the show that like the only guy who in the cast who was in the military is David, and he was presumably drafted to go to Vietnam.
Oh yeah, because everybody was.
I don't think David's signing up for the military.
No,
everything we know about his character, I don't think he's signing up for the Marines. I think he's getting drafted into the Marines.
Oh no, he's getting drafted, and then he does so well that he goes into the Marines.
Then he, no, I mean, and right after the Marines, he went to university and continued in law enforcement.
Well, and the other thing is he may have even signed up because you got the pick. Like, he knew he was going to get drafted, so.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So you're saying it might have been like the actual, my favorite story about the actual John Douglas, which is that he was worried about getting drafted.
And going
so he signed up for the Air Force.
Yeah, he signed up.
For the Air Force, because he knew that if he was in the Air Force, he wouldn't have to go to Vietnam. And even if he did, he'd be, even if he did get sent to the war, he'd be friggin' stationed in Japan doing maintenance on bombers. Because that's the thing. It's like, if you join the Air Force and you don't want to learn how to fly or like do in-flight support work, guess what? You're not going to be in combat. It is the safest, because that's the thing. If you join the Navy, whatever job you do, there's a good chance you're going to end up on a boat, right?
Yes.
Because the boats need thousands of bodies to run all these boats. But if you join the Air Force, like, so you're always going to be in danger, some kind of danger in the Navy. If you join the Air Force and show no interest in, like, learning to fly or learning to help on a plane, it is the safest possible job in the military. Because, like, the because that's the thing. Even because the Air Force, think about it. Like, they work, they worked from airfields not that were not in country. Like, all of there were now that there were in country airfields, but they were often Army air bases and Marine air bases. Like, the Air Force largely worked out of Vietnam. Worked out of Japan. In that war, because they would just, the Air Force mostly just had giant flights of bombers that they would constantly be, I mean, 24/7, you would just be sending bombers from Vietnam, from Japan to Vietnam. And that is what John Douglas did to make sure he didn't get killed in Vietnam.
And he he did not want to be part of the Vietnam rag.
And then the best part is, he didn't even get sent to Japan because he's like, you know, I'm really good at office work. Also, I have a degree in physical education, so how about I work on putting together a better physical education program for the people who work here stateside?
And he started working with children who were developmentally challenged.
That's true. He did.
And he he almost made that his life career.
Yeah.
Anyway.
But instead, he joined the FBI because there was more money in that. I'm kidding.
No, that's not why.
That's not why.
It's more complicated than that.
It's more complicated.
But
than that. I was just doing a joke about John Douglas. Yeah. No, but it's like, that's why I think Joe didn't volunteer, because I think Joe was drafted because no one who wanted to volunteer and to get out of combat would have volunteered for the Marines. The Marines are the one there in the dirt. So I think Joe was drafted. Mm-hmm. I think he, for the rest of his life, only did smart things for himself after he was stupid enough to get drafted.
Yeah.
Oh, anyway. But yeah, it's very weird watching this episode because basically it just becomes a murder mystery where, and I think that's what bothers me, because we were just talking a second ago about how fundamental the institution of respecting the military is to American identity, right?
Yeah.
And if the characters in the show, and I mean, the characters in the show often display that kind of opinion, right? But there's this corollary to it, which is military academies inherit, in a way, that respect, because generally military academies are seen as necessary for generating the next tier of leaders.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
And that's why they get away with all of this awfulness, because you're generating the next, we lionize the military more than we should, and we agree that there needs to be a next generation of leaders, so we give a lot of leeway, right, to these people, to the people who train that next generation of leaders. And that is the water in which the character René Auberjonois is playing swims, mm-hmm. right? He gets all of this deference because of the important role he plays in American military culture.
Yeah.
And if any one of the characters on the show felt that way, then it would be a twist that there was this brutal hazing going on, that there was this brutal hazing going on, and René Auberginois set up people to get murdered.
Yeah.
But the show undercuts its message by having all of the characters already be opposed to military academies when the show starts.
Yep. And Aaron is the only, Strauss is the only one who is sort of supporting the military until, of course, because she's been drinking, she blows it.
She just blows up and attacks, she blows up and attacks with, and says all of the theories, which, you know, turn out to be true. But the point is, like, but that's the thing. She's only standing up for the military academy because it's the director of the FBI. Let me think, what year was this episode? Robert Mueller's. So Robert Mueller's
FBI,
his alma mater, right?
Yeah.
And that's the only so that's the crazy part. Even she, the character supporting it, has no respect for this institution and is only doing it because it's Robert Mueller's alma mater. And we know she has no respect for the situation, how he runs things, because the second she gets drunk enough, she starts saying what she really thinks. Oh, God, it's such a weird episode.
Yes, and the thing is that Robert Mueller never went to a military academy like this.
I actually don't know. I mean, I know he
he didn't. He had an entirely different... He was also, remember, he's also of the generation that got drafted.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're right. He was not a military academy kind of guy, which, you know, good.
Yeah. So, he left the military and went into the FBI, got his law degree, but ended up in the FBI at some point.
Yeah.
It's fascinating, isn't it? It's fascinating.
Well, no, he left the FBI, and that's why he's such a weird figure, because he left the FBI, and then when terrorism started happening, he just became a private lawyer. And then when, like, terrorism started getting bad, he's like, okay, well, I'll just join the Justice Department then.
Yeah.
Because I think it's more important to work on this terrorism-related stuff than it is to, like, just make money. Which, way to go, dude. But the problem is, you spent 10 years focusing on Islamic extremism, and during that 10 years, white supremacists took over the country. So, you know, I can only be so respectful of Robert Mueller's achievements.
He didn't have a broader view, because, I mean, you have the whole problem of, oh God, the Oklahoma City bombing still.
Exactly.
Still.
It's horrifying. Yeah, but... And the FBI did a great job of going after, white supremacists for a good 5 years after the Oklahoma City bombing. And then 9/11 happened, and then suddenly the FBI was like, we don't care at all about Nazis. We're going to start inventing terrorist cells and killing and busting them so that we can pretend that we are successfully fighting terrorism here. And we're just going to ignore white supremacists. And the white supremacists took that as a sign that they could, run Russia over the entire country, which is exactly what they frigging did. And that's why we are where we are now.
Where they are. Remember, it is during that period of time. Well, yes, but we have called that one group has been in Canada called a terrorist group.
A hate group, and thank God.
No, a terrorist group. It's not a terrorist group now.
Well, thank God for that. But my point is, it's like, the problem with living in Canada is all this stuff redounds to us.
Yes.
The massive amount, we all speak the same language, we all look the same. So when a bunch of Nazis start getting really powerful in America, guess what?
Yeah.
The Nazis decide they can get powerful in Canada too. Like, it's not accidental that we had the uptick in racist violence at the same time America did.
Well, it's always later. It's always later.
You're right.
Always later. It's like the
feminist movement. It is a ripple on a pond.
Yes, yeah,
it's a ripple. Ripple on a pond.
Yeah. And we do tend to, hopefully we will be better at fighting it off. But I don't know.
Crossed.
Anyway, we'll see the next election.
Yeah, we'll see
I just got my phone call today, or are you going to be willing to make the phone calls and stuff? Yes.
Of course.
Sign me up, of course.
The other
can
side
I put a,
of
can
what?
I put a
sign on, the lawn?
On
of
sign?
Course.
Yeah, of course you can.
Dear Liberal Party, the other side have white supremacists on them. Yes, you can have whatever support you want. I don't honestly don't care what your policies are right now.
No,
the Nazis exactly. are on the other side of this.
I don't care. You can do the mountain. We could whatever. I mean, I got a text message from Doug Ford's Ontario Premier's Conservative Party. And it was one of those stupid text messages that asking you basically are you what was that? What was the exact wording? Just a sec. I just have to do this.
While she's going to look for this ridiculous thing, I want to say thank you for sticking around for Canadian Politics Corner. It's weird how we got here because I think it's organic because we were talking about the corrosive attitudes created by military academies and how the episode both wanted to comment on that. But didn't allow for the but in all of the stuff with the boy's father being a secondary villain, like the fact that they added the boy's father as a second villain, whereas the villain of this episode, like this episode would have been a good episode. It would have been extreme, would have been a little unrealistic, but it would have been a good episode if the villain of the episode was 100% René Auberjonois and the culture of violence he created.
It's like somehow or another, you know, this man who sent his son to the military academy is in part responsible for...
Yeah.
You know, yeah, I mean,
his son was too fragile and he couldn't take it. No, the only bad guy here is René Auberjonois.
Well, it's not
and if
just...
they had done this episode the way they should have, with him trying to get the upperclassmen to murder the kid who was going to stand up to him, then you've got an episode that is actually saying something concrete about military academy culture and overall culture of militarism. But because they add this extra thing of the dad goes nuts and does a bunch of nonsense, then...
And René Auberjonois sends him a text message telling him where...
Telling him where the... Oh, no. Just have your kids kill the other kid. And then it goes awry because he's able to stand up to them.
Yeah.
You know? And he kills them mostly in self-defense.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And that would have been... I mean, and that is exactly the episode you expect. And I suspect that rather than write that episode, Erica Messer decided we have to have a twist and we have to have a, you know, and that's why you get the father, and the father is, you know, so that you kill off the father, you know, so he doesn't have to live with what he's done.
But honestly, like they think the kid did it, and the kid should have done it. But the kid should have done it for a damn good reason, i.e. those other kids had been sent out to kill him.
Yeah.
And, you know, that especially makes sense why at the end of the... And if that's the plot, then it sure as hell makes sense why René Auberjonois' sidekick goes out into the woods to execute the kid at the end of the episode.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, this whole episode makes perfect sense if those kids were sent to kill this kid, and this kid killed them instead.
Yep.
Yeah, but then you don't get the image of all the kids hanging them from trees in the, oh, was it a mass suicide, and blah, 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 blah. Like, maybe just don't obsess about your imagery. By the way, the imagery makes no sense. All of the kids, all of the kids' nooses were tied around the actual branches? And I'm like, how did he get up there to do that? Did he bring a ladder?
I was going to say, where are the ladder marks?
Exactly. Like, because we see him, later we see him on the ground hoisting them up. And I'm like, yeah, you could hoist them up by throwing a really long sheet over those branches. But then how did you tie the branch up top after you hoisted them up, guy? No. Like, give up your strange fruit imagery and make this episode what it was supposed to have been.
Yeah. Because if you go with the strange fruit imagery, right, then you're what are you saying? That these guys were martyrs and they were lynched?
Yeah, like, because if you got all these kids hanging from a tree, like, suddenly they've become martyrs. Martyrs? To, like, their mass suicide becomes martyrs to bullying? Like,
no, yeah, like, it's just, it's there is so strange.
People, lots of people hanging from trees is a frigging powerful image.
And white guys don't get lynched.
Yeah. Yes.
I'm sorry. I mean,
unless it was an episode about a black guy killing a bunch of people to avenge a lynching by lynching them. Yeah. But when they do that episode, the black guy doesn't lynch anybody. Sadly. They do that episode eventually, by the way.
Yeah, I know.
And it won an Image Award.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they gave an Image Award to the writer of that episode. And I'm like, way to go. All right, so I think we're going to wrap this up here. Did you end up finding that terrible message from Doug Ford?
Oh, yes, I did.
And what is it?
Okay, so here's the fake. Well, technically it's not from Doug Ford. It's from Ontario Strong.
Jesus Christ.
Which is like our version of the American PAC.
Yeah.
So, hi, this is Sue from Ontario Strong. Do you agree that we must scrap the carbon tax? Respond yes, no.
No.
Well, so what I wrote was, no, I do not agree. No.
I like what they're really saying is, do you agree that all of our grandchildren should boil to death so three rich guys can live in a super yacht?
Yeah.
No, I don't agree with that.
No.
I actually don't agree with that. I don't agree with giving billionaires super yachts. Is that a controversial statement suddenly?
Oh, God.
All right. I'm just saying. My conspiracy theory, by the way.
Yeah.
My conspiracy theory is that the reason New Zealand keeps getting left off of maps and globes is that all of the rich people in the world plan to move there, and after the world ends, then nobody will be able to find them. Because without satellites and GPS, how are you ever going to find New Zealand? That's why they're taking it off the maps.
Okay, let's talk about next week.
Yeah, what three are we doing next week, please?
We're doing something called The Bittersweet Science.
Oh, no! Another... Oh, the one about the crazy boxer! Okay.
Yeah, the sisterhood reigns supreme again.
All right, next up.
True Genius.
Oh, okay. That one I remember.
And then Unknown Subject.
What is Unknown Subject?
When a series of sexual assaults in Houston, Texas contain the signature of a prolific serial rapist, the BAU reopens the original investigation.
Wait, is that literally the episode I was just talking about? Where I couldn't remember whether the rapist gets murdered at the end?
Yeah, and finds himself pitted against a victim with her own brand of justice.
Yeah, okay, I think that's it.
That's it.
Okay.
Yeah. And as Prentice is struggling with the anniversary of her battle with Ian Doyle.
Oh. Are we that far into the episode? No, we're not that far into the season.
No, this is just January. Didn't he just get killed like...
I'm saying she's talking about last year when Ian Doyle stabbed her almost to death.
Okay.
That's what they mean. All right. So join us back here. That's your homework if you're watching this along with us. Join us back here next week for 7:10 to 7:12. A Bittersweet Science, True Genius, and Unknown Subject. It should be a lot of fun.
Well, it can't be as much fun as these.
Do you want to hear an amazing coincidence?
What?
Was that a lot of amazing coincidence as I've been powering through reviewing Criminal Minds as we've also been recording this these past 2 months? And this week, I literally just yesterday, I reviewed the episode that is entirely about Garcia's family, like her parents getting killed in that car accident. And now, and I'm like, didn't we already know this story about her, them being out looking for her? Like, I feel like when they died. And then this is the episode, like, the next day, we're talking about the episode where that happened.
Yeah.
And they've changed it. They actually changed it in the intervening years. Here she says she got a phone call saying that her parents had been killed. And in that episode, literally 1 second after she walks in the door, a cop car drives up. So, you know. They changed it around a little. I will say this, though, and I'll say this again when we're reviewing season 13 here on the show. They did a really good job at casting 18-year-old Garcia. Like, it is dead on what a good job they did with 18-year-old Garcia. Like, thumbs up to that casting. All right.
Unlike the casting in
Who else did we see young?
No. I was talking about the casting in Epilogue.
Oh. Yeah, okay. All right. Sorry, now I'm coughing. This is going to be a perfect time to wrap things up. Thank you so much for making it through the anti-military and politics rant that we went out there at the end. But it's the episode's fault. The episode did this to us.
It's nice to be able to blame an inanimate object.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. We're blaming the work of real people.
Yes.
We're not blaming the show as a thing. We're blaming the messages that were created by people making creative choices. So, no.
Yeah. It's yeah. I mean, and there is so much in that
episode.
Terry episode that is so wrong. As I said, I keep going. I really have to find, if anybody who's listening actually knows if Scientology Act takes positions on anything besides psychiatry, we'd love to know, like, ethical or moral positions. Like, what is their position?
She's been trying to do research for a couple of weeks now about is there any such thing as ethics in Scientology? And she's having a rough time finding it.
Like, do they have a position on suicide, for example?
Do they have a position on war? Do they have a position on child abuse? Like, what is their... What exactly, discipline. It's weird.
Well,
in my head,
head,
I'm thinking of children. This is how political I've gotten, or some might say realistic I've gotten, that in my head, when I think of people disciplining their children, the word that comes out of my mouth is child abuse.
Yes. I have. Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes, yes. No, it worked. It worked. All of the Alice Miller stuff. It totally worked. All right. So we're going to call it there. We will see you back here next week. If you want to reach out to us via email because you have questions, comments, or suggestions about other profiling-related fiction we should check out, we'd love to hear from you. Drop us a line at profilingcriminalminds@gmail.com. And if you're listening to this on some kind of a podcast service instead of streaming it from Podbean, please be sure to rate the episode because apparently that helps people find it. We will see you back here next week for more Criminal Minds Season 7. And of course, drop by on Monday for our continuing journey through Suspect Behavior, a better show about the same thing. Okay. But until then, we'll see you there. But until then, au revoir.
And have a good weekend.
Profiling Criminal Minds is a member of the Kinks Podcasting Network.